Take a network break, grab a virtual donut, and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. We've got stories from Palo Alto Networks, Dell Technologies, and much more. Greg, before we dive in, you just wanted to say a word to the folks at NASA.
I mean, what an amazing effort to land a lander on the moon with all of this fancy technology.
On Mars.
No less. I watched the whole thing. Well, I watched them reading it out with an 11-minute delay. Mm-hmm. It was funny. They were reading it out as though it was really happening. Did you watch it?
I caught a few highlights here and there. I didn't watch it live.
Yeah. It was interesting because they were reading it out. And the first thing I thought is like, are they trying to tell me that there's not a multiple minutes delay? And the answer is no. They were literally reading it out as the 11 minute, as they received these signals coming back. And it was really interesting. But, you know, it came in, it had to eject the heel shield, it had to deploy the parachute, then it had to deploy the rocket thing, which would come down and then place the lander and the rocket engine. Amazing thing. Automation, you know, robotics off the planet. And of course, I'm sitting here thinking like I can barely automate a network and these guys can fly a rocket to the moon for 6 months in the most hostile environment and land it on the spot. It's like, anyway, so I was watching it with a sense of amazement and inadequacy at the same time. Is that wrong?
No, absolutely. I mean, yeah, thinking of all of the things that had to go right and the fact that troubleshooting, you were literally millions of miles away. that's pretty impressive.
It has to run completely.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's on an 11-minute signal back to Earth. What are you going to do?
Right.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Just mind-bogglingly clever, I thought. I thought it was genuinely an amazing achievement.
It's a magnificent achievement and makes me feel great about technology and what people can do when they work together on a common goal. It's wonderful stuff.
Yeah, it is. Really was great to watch. I enjoyed it. I'm all into this space thing now that networking in space is a thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They're becoming more of one thing, which is kind of fun. Brings back my old dreams of being an astronaut that have since left me. But
oh, not a fireman anymore.
Nope. Put that behind me. Found out how much math was involved and I was like, nope, never mind. In any case, let's do a show. We're sponsored in part today by Palo Alto Networks. They are excited to introduce a fundamentally new approach to cloud-delivered security with Prisma Access 2.0. You can find out more about it in the upcoming Prisma 2.0 Access launch event, March 17th, 10 a.m. Pacific. You'll hear about the latest industry trends and customer perspectives from industry leaders in addition to everything new about Prisma Access 2.0. You can register at start.paloaltonetworks.com/Prisma-access-2-launch, or you can just find the link in the show notes that accompany Network Break 321. And then stay tuned after the podcast for a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation. We're going to talk to Silver Peak, to their customer Interbank on their rollout of Silver Peak SD-WAN, where they improve voice quality and application performance for the bank. All right, let's dive into the news. Palo Alto Networks is spending $156 million in cash to acquire Bridge Crew. This is a startup that aims to identify security issues early in the development cycle, things like misconfigurations in a template that would get reproduced hundreds of thousands of times. And instead of going back and fixing all those misconfigs, the goal is to catch it early.
Yeah, this is really interesting idea here. What they're actually doing here is automating the security of cloud infrastructure. So when your developers commit a change and deploy to the cloud, this tool actually reviews the code that they're using for the deployment and detecting whether it's outside of a policy or whether it's a security risk. Uh-huh. So this is the nichiest of niches in a way. Because what it actually is doing is scanning your infrastructure as a code base and the deployed resources, finding misconfigurations, and then giving you the tools to fix those issues fast. So the idea is that as developers deploy code to off-premises infrastructure, you know, AWS, Google, Azure, there's no audit or review process. These people are often doing uncontrolled, doing it in an insecure way, not deliberately, just because, you know, it's all pretty complicated. There's nothing simple about AWS or, you know, Azure. They're all proprietary. They're inordinately complicated. There's no tech support. There's very little training. And developers kind of are busy doing something else. You know, the idea of caring about the infrastructure beyond them. So this idea of an automated thing is really interesting. It's a really interesting idea. And it's conceptually congruent to what a firewall does. Because what a firewall does, when you simplify it down, is it's an external security control. And it's implemented in the infrastructure so that if application issues go wrong, the external check is a balance against bad behavior internally. So the point, the firewall perimeter was always meant to be an unrelated activity so that the developer couldn't allow traffic in that shouldn't have been allowed in. But in the cloud, that's exactly what they're wanting to do. They want to move fast and break things, you know. And this is in the step of move fast, but prevent you from doing bad things. Put up guardrails on the side of the speedy road.
Right. The whole infrastructure as code movement, while it enables automation, it also sort of sets up these chains of dependencies where mistakes can slip in. So when you're working off essentially what is supposed to be a master template, you want to make sure that master template is right because you don't want to propagate mistakes throughout the whole system. So it makes a lot of sense, although I do agree it's a little bit nichey, and I'm not quite sure, you know, who they intend to sell this to, because will developers buy it, or is it the security team or the, you know, audit team supposed to get it? I'm not quite sure, but an interesting addition to their portfolio.
Well, this is where we talk about, you know, the next article is Azure's premium firewall. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it in the context of that. So let's explain what the Azure premium firewall is.
Yeah, so Microsoft announced the preview of premium firewall. It's a new option for their cloud service. The premium tier has capabilities like TLS inspection, IDS and IPS, URL filtering, and secure web gateway. So it's essentially a next-gen firewall that you can now set up and run in Azure instead of their original firewall, which is more focused on essential sort of stateful inspection and NATing features.
Yeah, so this is an application firewall. This is the very thing that companies like Palo Alto Networks are about. It's an instance which the traffic comes in, and they're actually talking about it doing TLS inspection, intrusion detection and prevention services. It's doing web filtering and URL filtering. That is exactly what these application firewall companies are doing. Mm-hmm. So if Azure is going to deploy its version directly competitively to you, what do you do to add value to that? Because otherwise, you know, you're not going to compete against it. Now, it's an interesting competitive dynamic because Palo Alto, of course, you know, we're talking here about Bridge Crew doing automated testing. So you want the Palo Alto firewall there if you've got developers doing stuff, because Azure's not going to do that. It just wants to sell compute minutes, you know, mm-hmm. and if giving it to you as an application firewall is a way to increase the cost of a CPU, that's exactly what they're going to do. But they're not going to help you control that. How do you audit those rules? How do you validate those rules? So when the developer deploys something, right? Yeah. And we've seen other people. So AppVueX, for example, has been emphasizing their key management features. One of the critical parts about doing TLS inspection is making sure that you have the keys, you rotate the keys, that you manage the keys, keep the keys secure, and all that sort of stuff. And it's going to be interesting to see just how far Microsoft does this. But also keep in mind that a lot of enterprises are going with a multi-cloud solution. That means they've got on-premises, they're going to have something in Azure, they're going to have something in one of the other clouds most likely. Do you really want to have different brands of firewalls that you're trying to manage and keep going? So the challenge here for Azure's premium firewall product is if the only place you are is Azure, then this premium firewall makes sense. If you're in, you know, two data centers and three other clouds for whatever reason, are you actually, is this the right solution for you? Do you really want a multi-vendor firewall strategy? So it's just interesting that, you know, they're adding, so I think we're seeing the application firewall makers add products in adjacent markets to say, we've got a broader feature set. We've got more features than they have, but also they should be playing the one solution for all your needs angle.
For sure, for sure. I mean, frankly, I've got a couple of thoughts about the Azure premium firewall. You know, aside from TLS inspection, things like IDS, IPS, URL inspection, all that, those quote unquote next-gen features have been around for years. And I'm surprised that Microsoft is just getting to it now in a firewall offering. I don't know what was holding them back, unless they had those capabilities in other products and now they're just bundling together. I'm not sure. The other thing is you raised the point that this is a challenge for security companies and others who are trying to play the game in the cloud, where the cloud providers can start to eat away at their feature set. So, you know, AWS and Azure and Google are all going to start building security services. Why do I need to buy a third party if I can get it natively from my cloud provider? I think the response to that is, as you pointed out, have one firewall that you use for the management and policy and rule issues. So I think that's the counterweight there. But again, it's also, you know, cloud's probably managed in a silo, so your Azure team might like the Azure firewall better and for some reason want to use it. So there's going to be this trade-off.
Yeah, you know, if you're in Azure deploying a service on Azure and you're a developer, and then you're saying, well, why can't I just use this Azure firewall? And of course, yeah. And then all of a sudden you've got this multi-vendor firewall strategy and you're trying to keep the policy coherent. Now you've got to skill up on this, you know.
Right, it can be a mess. Yeah. The other thing that's interesting is how much they're touting TLS inspection, which again is an issue because TLS is supposed to keep everything private and secure. And by breaking that chain, You're potentially introducing security risks. There's also additional complexity with TLS 1.3, which has perfect forward secrecy. So there's some additional work that has to be done there. And Azure didn't share a lot of details on how they're doing that, but it's curious to see them touting TLS inspection because a lot of organizations were worried about their security tools going dark.
My concern there is that Azure wants to charge you per CPU cycle for this, and they've got no incentive to be efficient, to write good code here.
Right.
And, you know, so... Here's our application firewall, just paid by the CPU. The fact that I'm running a V12 engine when a three-cylinder clapper would do is, you know, neither here nor there. That's your problem, not mine.
That's that inbound TLS inspection where you're having to break out individual session keys and decrypt them. You could watch that bill start to run up pretty quick.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Anyway, just a thought.
Sure. So links in the show notes if you want more. We'll move on. Dell, they've announced a new private cloud option in their Dell Technologies Cloud Platform. The Dell Technologies Cloud Platform ships you a fully integrated rack to your data center enterprise. In this new private cloud option, customers can use their own racks, their own cables, their own PDUs, their own switches, and they don't have to license VMware Cloud Foundation as part of the bundle.
Yeah. So immediate reaction, this looks like HP's Emerald. You know, this pay-as-you-go, you know, just buy the VM.
Yeah.
And it comes down to about $25 per VM. And then you read the small print estimate based on the purchase of 500 compute optimized instances for new private cloud deployments over a 3-year term with all flash storage, vSphere, Enterprise, vSAN, Enterprise, and customer provided rack infrastructure with an average monthly price of $12,240 USD. Uh-huh. So that's a minimum spend of around $150,000 a year.
Yes.
So that's not a lot in some senses. They'll come and deploy, you know, if you're an organization that needs 500 VMs, compute optimized instances and the storage, that's fundamentally, you know, $150,000 a year is way cheaper than one EMC storage array. Uh-huh. So, you know, not overly expensive. And then you go on and scale up in instances of 25, 50, 100, 200 from there. I would imagine that this is some sort of hyper-converged infrastructure stack. So it's the vCloud, VMware, hyper-converged.
I believe the infrastructure is the VxRail.
Yeah. You know, if you think the idea of renting your infrastructure is a good idea, well, this looks like something that works well. It's also integrated with Dell's Cloud Console, which is both HPE and Dell made a number of acquisitions of cloud companies who made cloud-based consoles to manage your on-prem infrastructure. Uh-huh. And this snaps into that. So if you've already got Dell's Cloud Console, this allows you to unify the on-demand and some of the cloud-based as a service. So you can start to unify resource allocations in Dell's public cloud service that they host, as well as start to manage this subscription service of what you get, as well as your existing VMware infrastructure, the stuff that you bought and licensed and owned and probably operate today. So there's a transition going on there, I think.
Yeah, we're also seeing, you know, organizations wanting to consume on-premises infrastructure more like a cloud infrastructure. That's the whole HCI movement. So Dell has a variety of options here. My reading between the lines on this is that maybe Dell was finding some potential customers didn't want to swallow the cost of that VMware Cloud Foundation license that came with the original version of this. So for instance, that they price it out, 500 instances with the VMware Cloud Foundation is $23,000 a month with this new private cloud option that's just using VMware, not VMware Cloud Foundation. You're looking at $12,000 a month, so almost half the price.
Yeah, and you're also in your racks. So I don't have to throw out my racks.
Right.
Or if I'm going into a co-location facility who supply the racks.
Right.
Like, you don't always get a co-location facility where you can put your own racks in. You don't just get floor space. Sometimes you only get the choice of using, here's your racks. And they supply the power bars and all that sort of stuff. And that's all you get. That's your choice. Now, I think a lot of customers are in those facilities or want to use those facilities, and Dell's coming around to meet that need. So yeah, interesting cap in the market. If anybody's got any feedback, I'd be interested to hear, you know, if that's attractive to you and what it was that particularly attracted you to it.
Yeah, if you want to let us know, packetpushers.net/FU, FU for follow-up. All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Palo Alto Networks. Enterprises are adopting a hybrid cloud strategy to meet the demands of remote work now more than ever. Unfortunately, legacy secure access solutions leave remote workforces vulnerable to threats. Palo Alto Networks is excited to introduce a fundamentally new approach with Prisma Access 2.0. As the industry's only complete cloud-delivered security platform, it provides more security coverage than any other solution. You can find out more about the upcoming Prisma Access 2.0 launch event on March 17th, taking place 10 a.m. Pacific. You'll also hear the latest industry trends and customer perspectives from industry leaders. Don't settle for incomplete security. Learn about Palo Alto Networks Prisma Access 2.0, the industry's only complete cloud-delivered security platform. Again, March 17th, 10 a.m., this live event. You can register at start.paloaltonetworks.com/prisma-access-2-launch. That's the number 2. One more time, start.paloaltonetworks.com/prisma-access-2-launch, or find the show notes for Network Break 321 and just hit that link. Right, back to the news. NVIDIA has announced a dedicated GPU for cryptocurrency miners. They're calling it NVIDIA CMP, and the goal is basically to ensure that its GeForce GPUs are available for gamers rather than being snapped up by the cryptocurrency crowd.
Yeah, I put this in because it's interesting that, you know, if you're a company that makes GPUs, you probably don't care who buys them, right? As long as they're all bought and you get your money and book your profits and shareholders are rolling around in dividends, right?
Right.
But what's actually happening here is NVIDIA is effectively saying we regard the gaming market as important as the crypto market. And there's so much demand for crypto right now, of course, with, you know, the various shenanigans going on, some of it good, most of it not so great, that people have got a renewed interest into, you know, doing their own crypto mining all of a sudden, and they can't keep up with the supply of these GPUs. And of course, we've seen ASICs, you know, manufacturing problems, demand, et cetera, et cetera. We've talked a lot about that in previous shows. Uh-huh. So what they're saying here is we're actually going to create two different chips, one for crypto miners and one for gamers. And we're actually going to make it so that the one for gamers is almost unusable for mining crypto.
Right.
And that way gamers get to game and they get the chips that they want and they don't get angry at NVIDIA for not supplying the chips, and they get to hold on to that market while they ramp demand. And the crypto miners get something that they want because they put some sweets in there to say, we're going to modify the ASIC so it's more optimized for generating crypto mining or for crypto generation type software.
Yeah, I think what's interesting here is that it's not just that NVIDIA is releasing a specific GPU for a specific use case, but they're actually spiking an existing product for that use case, i.e. they can detect if you're using the GeForce, the gaming GPU for crypto mining, and then they'll essentially crash the hashing rate to reduce mining efficiency. So they're like saying, if we find you using this chip for cryptocurrency, we'll make the performance terrible. So don't buy it.
Which is
leave it for the gamers.
Yeah, right. And that's not new. That's something that Intel's done with its Intel CPUs over the years, right? Mm-hmm. And long before that, IBM CPUs in their mainframes, they used the same CPU in every one of their mainframes, but you bought a performance level. Mm-hmm. And then if you wanted to get up to the next performance level, an engineer would come out and sometimes you would cut a wire or, you know, flip a switch somewhere, and then all of a sudden the CPU would double in performance. So mm-hmm. that idea of crippling hardware for a particular purpose isn't new. Mm-hmm. Intel's done the same thing with various of its, you know, Celeron CPUs. They disable the L3 cache, or sometimes they claim that, you know, they're doing the testing off the runs, and if the chipset doesn't pass the testing, but it's the L3 cache that doesn't pass, well, then we can put it into the seconds bucket and sell it as a second level CPU, you know, whatever, or performance crippled.
Yeah.
But they've also just shipped CPUs with performance cripples. You, as they come out of the factory, you can burn through, put a current onto a particular line and pop a fuse, and then all of a sudden that's a crippled chip from going forward. So this isn't new per se, but what is surprising to me is that NVIDIA is making a market differentiation, and even to the point of differentiating the performance. They're not just backlocking, they're actually changing the ASICs for the different markets. So I guess, you know, we keep making fun of crypto, and at some point I'm probably going to end up with egg on my face going like, but, you know, strange. It's a strange, strange thing.
I will say there are some folks in my Twitter feed who got into Bitcoin early and are laughing at everyone who mocked it. So the egg is coming.
It feels that way, doesn't it?
It does.
I still don't know what it's used for, but all right. Can't deny that it, you know.
The thing. All right, moving on. A DNS security provider, Quad9, they've moved their headquarters from California in the United States to Zurich, Switzerland. The company says the move means Quad9 customers get the full protection of Swiss privacy laws, including compliance with GDPR. That's the set of privacy regulations established in the EU.
Well, the EU is kind of a furphy because they've got the strongest privacy protections in the world today. So if you comply with that, you're generally better than any other privacy laws that might exist in any other country, you know, including California and so forth, which are much less, you know, much less privacy focused, much more of a trade-off. But it's interesting that Quad9, which is a free DNS resolver, and it's run by Switch, which is a registry for various domain names. That's who's taking it over and doing some of the hosting. And I thought IBM was originally involved in the Quad9 business model when we first talked about it quite some time ago. It's just interesting that this is a privacy-focused service. We've seen Cloudflare emphasize the fact that it doesn't keep any of the records. Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit, you know, the point is that, yes, Cloudflare doesn't keep the records. Yes, they have an extreme privacy position to the point where they'll protect undesirable websites as a part of their policy because they, you know, they take their privacy idea to an extreme. Mm. But this is just saying, we're going to Switzerland, guaranteeing your privacy. So if you're into DNS privacy, maybe it's time to have a look at quad9.net and consider using that. And the reason it's called Quad9, of course, Drew, is because it's at 9.9.9.9 for the IP address.
All right.
And the IPv6 address is 2620:FE:9. So pretty smart stuff.
Yeah. It's always encouraging to me to see privacy being sold as a differentiator. And in this case, it's not just a marketing slogan. They've actually moved to a jurisdiction where privacy now has a legally enforceable framework. So it's not just, you know, glad handing or mouth words. It actually means something.
That's right. Yeah. I think the privacy part of DNS is not well understood. DNS over HTTPS has actually seen more DNS information gathered into fewer hands until the rest of the world catches up and deploys DOH servers, which please do hustle up, you know, and admittedly DOH is not a fix for all of our problems. DNSSEC would be better, but that's a next step that will come over time. We're still waiting for Bind to ship their DOH. They shipped a beta release this week, if I remember rightly. So, you know, I would be, you know, if you're doing it from home, Quad9 might be the right way to go.
All right. Links in the show notes. Moving on, Verizon Business has announced 3 new managed SD-WAN offerings in partnership with Cisco. The new offerings include a co-managed SD-WAN service using Cisco Viptela, where the customer handles the security and application policies, and Verizon handles things like faults, performance, and config management. There's also a fully managed SD-WAN using Viptela running on Cisco ISR 1100 series, and then a managed service using the Meraki gear.
Yeah, makes sense. Meraki's very much focused at the SMB, very tightly packaged, very low flexibility solution. And that's great because it does what it does. And it's hard for customers to make a mess of it. It's also hard for resellers to make a mess of it. And I would imagine that the Viptela option here will also be locked down. You'll only be allowed to use certain features under certain circumstances so that it doesn't get too diverse. When you're a company the size of Verizon, you're not going to embrace every use case in the world.
Right.
Because you just don't have the expertise for that, right?
Yeah.
You're going to get this sort of like, yes, you can use these features or you can deploy it in this way, but if you go outside of that, we're not going to support you kind of stuff.
You can have any color as long as it's black.
Yeah, that's right. You can have, and it's probably not even going to be a color. It's going to be like, this is the deployment you can have. And the Viptela solution will be there for some arcane reason that we don't quite understand. So yeah, that's how I see it. I think it's been about 2 years, I think, where I predicted that Cisco would lean more into using big companies to sell its products. Did I? Do you remember us talking about that about 2 years ago?
Yeah, we talked about it in a couple of examples recently. I think Cisco had a deal with Comcast we talked about recently.
Yeah. And I think this is in the same theme. It makes much more sense for somebody like Cisco to stop having thousands of resellers selling SD-WAN, and it's much more attractive to just have Verizon do it. And effectively one reseller instead of 1,000 resellers is much cheaper and easier to organize. I actually don't think that's actually true internally, but let's go with that as a theory. And I think this pulls on the principle or that on that thread of logic that I've thrown out there for a while now, that resellers will be less important to IT vendors going forward. I suspect that you'll see the big companies doing business with big companies because big companies like big companies because they are a big company to some extent. And this idea of having a large reseller base doing stuff doesn't make sense, because trying to keep them all happy is an incredibly difficult thing for an organization to do. And this is a step down that path. So I think, you know, this is a step down the path of Cisco de-emphasizing resellers. And there are other signs of this, right? Software monitoring replaces resellers' relationships. You know, this idea that there are SDN tools that are now reporting back to the cloud and using artificial intelligence to tell if the network's working. And if the reseller can't cope, Cisco's going to know, because they're going to see that the network's not working right. And they can start to apply artificial intelligence and machine learning to the licensing data to trigger sales interactions. And all of a sudden, you know, a call goes out to Cisco, sees a message saying, oh, there's obviously a key point here for a sales interaction, but nobody seems to be servicing that account. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes ahead. But I actually suspect this is a bigger trend. We talk a lot about cattle versus pets, you know, this idea that we've got to treat infrastructure like, stop treating it like pets and treat it like cattle. And I've come to the realization that customers aren't pets anymore. You're also cattle. So, right? So you don't get treated with special gloves and you get special privileges and you get special food at, you know, you go, it's great. You're going to be like, cow number 110. <You know? laughs> Right. What do you need? Okay. That's your 10 minutes. Get out of the way on next one. Do you know what I mean? Now, I wonder if people are prepared for that sort of model change that we're seeing. And I think I might start talking about that more going forward, because I've come to the conclusion that that's, if your infrastructure is not pet, neither are customers.
I mean, I guess I would push on that by saying that sort of swings the argument back toward a reseller could say, we will treat you like a pet rather than a cattle, particularly depending on the size of the reseller, if they're maybe a little more smaller, a little targeted, where each customer is individually important to them for their business, then they can make that claim. I think if you were going with a big telco or service provider for a managed service at any time, you were always cattle. Mm. That's always been there.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, the public cloud, like if you, as a customer of Azure.
Oh yeah, you're not treated like a,
that's all cattle, right?
Yeah.
And what happens is, if you're going to subscription licensing, there's no sales relationship here.
Right.
It's just pay the money and we'll continue to service you. And I think customers are going to end up having to look after themselves. They're going to be treated like cattle. They'll have portals, low-cost ways of doing business. The big companies will make more money for less effort than they do today. And I don't think there's any room for resellers in that model. I think the reality is that the skills that are in the resellers go inside the customers in the long term, because that's where the cattle are.
Again, I mean, I guess I disagree, because I feel like the reseller can offer the touch level that if a customer wants, they're not going to get from a Verizon Business or an AWS or whatever. So, I think there is a market for that. So I think there's a place for smart resellers who can actually manage that customer high touch aspect.
Well, then we will watch out for that and debate that going.
All right. Let's get it on.
You've got to find you'll have to find some articles to support your case now.
I guess I do. Yeah. The burden's on me now. Yep. All right. Moving on. Greg, you found an article about that gives sort of a deeper look into the Google Loon project. This is the project they recently killed, where they were trying to deliver internet connectivity via high-tech balloons.
Yeah, this article's on Business Insider, which unfortunately is a paywall, but maybe you can find it if you know how. What was interesting about, you know, we talked about them shutting down the Loon project a couple of weeks back, but this article attempts to paint a version of failure which wasn't their fault, right? Which, rewriting history, right? Uh-huh. And the reality is that I suspect the real story here is that the Google Loon people are trying to blame it on the government because they weren't able to get permission to fly the balloons in the places that they needed. Mm. You've got to put the balloons in the air. They fly in the same space that airplanes fly. And they basically were incredibly hostile to governments across the world. They just said, we're going to fly these balloons and we don't care what you think. We're going to move fast and break things. We're ignoring air safety bodies. And then when they tried to fly the balloons in places like Kenya, the air safety bodies went like, well, you haven't done an air safety analysis. You know, what are you doing to... You know, and it also turned out that they didn't do a very good job of turning these products into robust, usable items. They treated it like a science project, and they made these one-off balloons. Instead of treating it like a factory product that would have to be robust and fly for years at a time, they would only last about 3 weeks before they had to be brought down, regassed, and recoated, you know, of all things.
Right.
But to me, it was the bit about, oh, the governments around the world wouldn't give us permission to fly the balloons. And then the governments were things like Is there any spy stuff in these balloons? Mm-hmm. Oh, no, we don't want you clogging up our airspace. So it really feels like an attempt to rewrite history and go like, oh, the failure wasn't our fault, when it really was their fault.
That's interesting. Yeah, I couldn't get to the article because of the paywall, but I could see some project managers wanting to feel like this wasn't our fault, and you can always blame the government.
Yeah, because you don't want balloons up at the same level of where jetliners fly, right? No, and jetliners are way more valuable than a couple of balloons providing interview. You know, that's not.
Yeah.
And, you know, I suspect Google might have created a certain amount of hostility with governments around the world, and these people sort of went like, well, oh, now you're coming to us for help, you know?
I was always disappointed that Google kind of threw in the towel when it came to trying to roll out Google Fiber, because they ran into such roadblocks from the incumbents. I feel like they have the money and the muscle and the connections to, if they really wanted, they could have pushed that through instead of trying to go for more exotic ideas like high-tech balloons.
Yeah, this was always a bad idea, I thought. You know, you never want to doubt, because, you know, look at SpaceX. That also was a bad idea. And it seems to have gotten legs, right? So, flip side is you've got to let it run. But I think at the same time, these organizations need to realize that hostility towards governments will eventually stab you in the back. You might get around them for a while, but eventually you'll have to get to the government, and they need to get them on side first, not offside them from the start, and then try and grovel back and say, please, will you help me? I've got a really good thing. You know,
yeah, exactly.
I think these companies do need to grow up and stop pretending they're like at university and going like, I'm not going to ask for permission. I'm just going to go and do it.
Right. Move fast and break things doesn't work well in commercial airspace. Let's say that.
Among other things. But yes.
All right. Link in the show notes if you can either pay Business Insider or find your way around it. Let's move on. We got two more stories before we wrap. You've probably heard about the winter storm in Texas that's caused massive disruption to the electrical grid. In addition to the human catastrophe, the loss of power has also affected the tech industry. Axios is reporting that both Samsung and NXP Semiconductor had to halt operations at plants in Austin, Texas, because of the power issues.
And apparently those plants are something like 20 or 30% of the U.S. silicon production. And it is a major problem. I think a couple of things that I wanted to raise about this is I'm not too worried about Texas and its power grid as somebody who works, you know, in the European market. But what it does highlight is that the power grid is critical to IT infrastructure. First of all, workers need it. Whether you're working at work or working at home, you've got to have electricity, right? You can't technologize. We've seen a lot of companies actually migrating out of California to Austin, Texas, particularly. Mm-hmm. Because there's no government there. And in this case, it turns out that what actually happened was that the Texas government is so low touch that the regulation of the electricity body was poor. And it turned out that while Texas has a diversified supply of wind energy, solar energy, oil, gas, coal, and nuclear, it turns out that wind and solar were entirely predictable. Now, that's what I mean by that. Is that wind and solar is predictable that in winter it will produce less power, but it doesn't fail. It just produces less power, but predictably so. Uh-huh. What happened here is that the weather caused unpredictable failures in the coal and nuclear plants. And the government of Texas basically failed to plan and prepare for predictable weather events. That is, we know that extreme climate activity is happening. We know that climate change is happening according to all the science. The scientists have been predicting that extreme climate events are going to go forward. They've even been highlighting that this year the polar vortex is going to cause a different winter than normal. And this is what caused it out. Now, the thing that I do want to point out was having a chat to somebody. He said, yeah, our data centers are going on to backup power. And I went, oh, that's okay. Then he said, yeah, but the point is that networks go out. He said, this happened to us a few years ago. And even though our data centers were still up, the networks that were feeding into them all went. Because eventually they run out of battery power if the electricity doesn't come back.
Right.
And you can still be out.
I guess a data center without a network connected to it is just a bunch of expensive servers burning electricity for no reason.
But you've still got to pay for because they're up.
Yep.
Useless, but up. So I think there's a couple of things here. One is that planning for weather in your infrastructure might be something that you need to think about in your networking. And you might want to think more carefully about the details there, instead of like, you've sort of got to the point where the internet is going to be there all the time. And if you don't stop and think about the physical requirements, you might miss that there's actually been a transition here, and maybe the internet is not always going to be up for extreme events. And in the old days when we ran our own data centers, we used to plan for this. We used to plan for floods and extreme power events and so forth and so on. And now we just sort of, I'll put it out. Don't worry. Put it in someone out. It's all done. But these issues will still affect us. And I wonder if we're going to be caught out more widely when infrastructure fails due to extreme weather.
Yeah, part of the issue is that U.S. infrastructure is very old. We need more resilient systems. The other issue is that we're going to get more severe climate events, hurricanes, blizzards, wildfires, heat waves, et cetera. And they're all going to stress infrastructure in different ways, in different places, at different times. So, yeah, we definitely need a more resilient approach to our infrastructure, including electricity.
Just worth thinking about if you're doing it, you know, or maybe not. Maybe you just ride into it. You know, we can't predict extreme weather into your policy at work and say, like,
give it a miss.
What am I going to do?
Things are going to happen. Yeah. What am I going to do? Just make sure you have a flashlight and warm blanket.
Mention it in a meeting and your man is going to look at you and tell you to shut up, most likely.
What they're going to say is, that's the policy. We just don't talk about it out loud.
Well, that's right.
All right, our last story for this episode. The Mobile World Congress is planning to hold an in-person conference in Barcelona, Spain, starting June 28th of this year. Event organizers say they are taking steps to ensure safety through protocols, including social distancing, mask requirements, limits on crowd density, touchless registration, and frequent cleaning. But this still sounds like a terrible idea.
I think somebody's developing a test for stupid people. I just can't imagine that 50,000 people in, like, the Fira of Barcelona is a big place and it's lovely and Barcelona is a wonderful town, but 50,000 people going to, you really think 50,000 people are going to fly to Barcelona? Because they can't, there's no other way to get there. Like, you're not going to be on a cruise ship, I don't think, or not too many people will drive there. You have to get on a plane. So if that means sitting in an airtight container with hundreds of other people, who are potential plague victims, and see how you go. I this boggles my mind. It doesn't matter what preparation they do. It's the travel to and from. That's the infection vector.
Well, there's the travel to and from. They also, I was looking at their infection control systems. They mentioned nothing about air circulation and air ventilation, and this is an airborne transmitted illness.
Yes.
Those things like, you know, frequent cleanings don't do anything because fomite transmission is really low. It's the air quality. And if you're cramming a bunch of people into it, it's hygiene theater is what they're doing. And the second part is, you know, I can't wait to get out of my house, but it is not worth the risk. It is really not to go to a... It's really not. So
I don't think anybody's going to go. Like, I was looking at the large vendors to see who's signed up, and nobody signed up yet. If you actually look at the committed supplies list, it's like none. There's really... Yeah.
Right. Why would you take the risk? Why would you endanger your employees?
Exactly. What is interesting is that Mobile World Congress in Shanghai will go ahead. But the point for Mobile World Congress in Shanghai is you actually, it'll be mostly for Chinese people who live in China, which is actually COVID-free to a larger extent. And they're welcome to travel and attend the event. But if you're going to speak, if you fly into China from any outside of the world, you actually have to go into a registered accommodation facility for 2 weeks and undergo testing. So to stand up on stage and speak for an hour or to go and man a booth is a month-long process. I was watching a video today of somebody who flew to Thailand. It took him 2.5 days because he had to stop at a particular place and have a COVID test before he got on the plane. And then when he got off the plane, it took 8 hours to deplane and get to his hotel. Right. Because he had to go through, they had to validate his paperwork on arrival. Then he had to go into one person per shuttle bus, right?
Wow.
To go to a special hotel. And that was one person per room, unless you're married, in which case it's two, but right. And you have to stay there for 2 weeks and you have to be tested every 3 days or something like that. Do you really want to go to a conference with that sort of stuff?
Mm-mm. Not worth it. Yeah. Not worth it.
I don't, I'm just a bit weird. Anyway.
And maybe we should put on the prediction spreadsheet whether this actually goes off in Barcelona or they decide to just go back to virtual.
Well, it just sounds like, the CEO says we're going to be number one in conferences by having a conference when nobody else will and hoping that people are dumb enough to turn up. And so here we go. The mobile industry, let's find out how dumb they all are.
There's the test. All right.
There's the test.
All right, well, that wraps up this news portion of the show. Please stay tuned for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation. We're talking with Silver Peak customer Interbank about their SD-WAN deployment. That's coming right up. Welcome to the Tech Bytes podcast. Today's topic is an SD-WAN deployment with Silver Peak customer Interbank. Interbank is a commercial lender that operates in more than 40 locations in Texas and Oklahoma in the United States. Our guest is Daniel Rule. He is Senior VP and Director of IT at Interbank. Daniel, welcome to the podcast. So 40 branches in this banking organization. I'm guessing it's fair to say that WAN is pretty essential to how the bank operates?
Yes, absolutely it is. So all of our locations are in very rural areas. And so connectivity, it's an absolute must. If they don't have connectivity, they essentially close their doors. All of our applications are hosted either in cloud or our own private cloud and, in our own data center. So if they don't have good, reliable WAN connectivity, they can do nothing pretty much.
Yeah. Business would grind to a halt. Yeah.
Yep.
And are you using anything like voice applications that rely on the network?
Yes, absolutely. All of our voice is all hosted. We use ShoreTel, which is now Mitel. Between voice and some of our critical applications are really sensitive to packet loss, even though they're TCP packet. So it's essential to have extremely good quality WAN service for us.
So given that a lot of your branches are in remote locations, did you have trouble finding connectivity and what kind of connections are you using? Can you get broadband? Is it MPLS? What's the setup look like?
So before we moved to Silver Peak, we were a pure MPLS only. We used Nitel, based out of Chicago. Nitel had done a phenomenal job getting us connectivity. There's always those outliers, if they're on a really bad provider, if there's not fiber available and, the copper in the ground, approaching over 50 years old in some of these really old towns in Oklahoma, Texas. So you have outages all the time or you got real bad packet loss. I mean, just.
Can I just interrupt you? So the idea here that the telcos don't have good infrastructure on these premium services, on these business services, and I assume you're going to tell us that you're now using internet. Is it true that the business services did not perform as well as the internet? Like just using broadband or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's actually a mix of both. The internet services may still not be 100% great, like what you get in a big city. But when you combine the two of them together with SD-WAN and Silver Peak's technology, it can use its parity packets, they call it, and it can put the data back together. So when it gets on the other end, the data is 100% there with no packet loss, essentially. So
is that a feature that's unique to Silver Peak? So sometimes we hear other SD-WAN vendors just doing simple stuff like load balancing over multiple bandwidths. But you're saying some of those sort of WAN acceleration type features are actually part of the basic product.
Not even really WAN acceleration. Silver Peak has WAN acceleration. They call it their Boost. And that's a separate thing that you don't have to buy. We're still doing a POC on their Boost just to see if we want to buy some. Today, we're just using their pure SD-WAN. And I'm not sure if there's other SD-WAN providers that are doing the packet parity basically. But I know that Silver Peak does a phenomenal job at doing that. You build in their overlays, you tell it how critical you classify your data with access list on which data you want to have to go over both WAN circuits. Mm-hmm. Cause some stuff, like if you got Wi-Fi or just general internet traffic that you don't care a lot about, you just tell it to go down whatever is the best circuit or best path and don't worry about it.
But what I'm saying is it's not just a case of some vendors SD-WAN is very focused on security features and they all get, the scanning engines and blah, 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 and all that. And that might be what you want. And there are other implementations of SD-WAN, which are just like, we balance the traffic left and right, like on circuit A, circuit B, circuit C, circuit D. One of the things is that I always hear, because we talk to Silver Peak customers a lot on this show, is that that these acceleration or these features that come from the WAN environment, as you say, with the additional checks and knowing that the packets got through, they're all standard features that separate the Silverpeak product from some of the others.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, because even if you're in the big city, I see this all the time, because we have locations that are in, you know, Dallas, Fort Worth, Oklahoma City, where you're on fiber or whatnot, and you would expect that your MPLS, for so to speak, would be, you know, 100% perfect. Well, it's not. No matter what circuit, no matter what provider you have, nothing's ever perfect. You know, I mean, there's always something, you know, whether it's some congestion or, you know, who knows, that's out of your control. So the Silverpeak does a phenomenal job with that. With a customer like us, we're not really so, we're not concerned about the IPS, IDS, things like that on the SD-WAN side, because we're not breaking out any of our internet locally. We're sending all that back to our data center. Okay. We're running that through our big Palo Altos, where we can do decryption, you know, the things that Palo Alto shines on, we're letting it do. Silverpeak, you know, is really great. I know that they're wanting to add some security stuff in the future, but for me, it's not important. What Silverpeak is doing today, that's what I wanted.
But you've got this rural network where you've got this lots and lots of small branches in remote parts where the telco infrastructure is degraded, shall we say, or out of date. That's really where you found the value.
Yes, absolutely.
So was it essentially, I mean, how did you get to SD-WAN? How did that come up on your radar? And then how did Silverpeak rise to the top for you?
So it started out that, you know, in Oklahoma and Texas, but there's providers out there that, you know, that fiber cuts a lot, whether it's a backhoe, you know, there's the jokes about backhoes hitting fiber and all that.
Yes.
For us, it happens quite regularly. It's probably, you know, we probably have one or multiple locations affected by a fiber cut probably monthly.
Wow.
So in the past, to fix that, we were buying commodity grade internet, putting a Cisco ASA in and doing our own DMVPN back to one of our data centers, you know, and doing BGP failover so that, you know, if their MPLS lost their BGP neighbor, it would fail over to the internet circuit. And that's okay. But, you know, a lot of times your performance is limited. And so we just wanted a more robust WAN out there. And, you know, we ran in some of our WAN circuits or MPLS circuits that were having packet loss. And on traditional Cisco network, you have no visibility in to see that packet loss. You know, you call your MPLS provider and say, hey, we think we're having some packet loss. This application's running slow. And about all they can do is sit there and run a ping, you know, to your router and go, hey, all your pings are getting there. You know, looks
fine to us. How sweet was it? Because one of the things about the Silverpeak SD-WAN, you have this monitoring capability where you can actually see the performance. And you could actually send that to your telco and then go like, okay, you have to do something about it. You can't just brush me off anymore.
Trust me, I've done that probably two or three times when we've had, you know, I've got one circuit in particular that goes through about three different telcos before it gets to the location. And, you know, it always has 2-3% packet loss, no matter what. It's always 2-3%. And I've actually sent those graphs, those charts you spoke of, to our MPLS provider and say, hey, send these to AT&T and tell them, fix this, you know?
Yeah, this is hard data. You can't ignore this.
Yeah,
this
you can't ignore this. Yeah. And I'm a big Cisco guy, and I'm a big, I've done Cisco, our own Cisco networking forever. And we did, you know, we do all of our own networking in-house and always was, you know, just love Cisco because it just worked. Well, it works networking wise, but getting into the visibility and seeing what's going on with your network, it's almost non-existent. And, you know, I mean, you can do NetFlow and some stuff like that, but that's an absolute nightmare. With Silverpeak, just there in your orchestrator. You bring up a tab and say, hey, I want to see, I'm clicking on this appliance. I want to see my loss to all the other appliances. And it pulls the table up and you sort it and you can say, oh, I got, you know, 5% packet loss to this, you know, this location. And, It's just super simple.
I can imagine you wanting to send some NetFlow records to your telco to have them look at that and talk about packet loss, and they'd be like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, the old ways of doing telemetry, because this is actually a telemetry, you know, we used to pull NetFlow and then try to reassemble the flows in a database and use it to interpret, but it was interpolation. It wasn't accurate. Whereas in the case of SD-WAN, this is a device in the path and it's already tracking each packet to some level of sophistication. And these SD-WAN tools are actually telemetry solutions, and they provide a data source of such high fidelity that the telco can't ignore you.
Yeah, I send the charts to Nitel. You know, when we're looking at, we just an example, Cox Communications in Oklahoma City did some equipment replacement a couple of weeks ago, and when it came back up, we noticed just by looking at our charts, we noticed that one of our data centers in Oklahoma City going to Nitel to their POP, we gained 10 milliseconds in latency after Cox did this work that they replaced some router and some equipment. And, you know, I was able to send those charts, you know, and they're really great charts, and it shows the latency in one of the charts, and you can see exactly when, like at midnight when they made the change, where the packet or the latency was back up. And, you know, I sent those to Nitel, and, you know, one of the responses back from one of their engineers was like, those are some amazing charts. Yeah.
So you mentioned, you know, you're a Cisco shop, you really like them. There's a million SD-WAN providers out there. How did you land on Silver Peak in particular, given how many choices you had?
Well, a lot of it was reading, you know, Gartner is always a good start. I've always loved looking at the Magic Quadrants, and that gives you a good start to start digging in. Mm-hmm. And then honestly, you know, I just looked around on the online community, looked at Reddit. I'm a member of a bank discussion group called FSISAC, mm-hmm, that we pay a membership for.
Yep.
Other banks are on there talking about SD-WAN. You know, that topic comes up quite a bit in their email discussions. And, you know, guys were just mentioning that they absolutely love Silver Peak. And I look at it on with my ROI as a financially, is that I can start cutting back or keeping my MPLS circuit speeds the same, you know, instead of going in and saying, okay, we're now needing more bandwidth at site A, let's increase it from 10 meg to 50 meg. And then of course your price goes up considerably on the MPLS. Right. Now I can say, well, let's keep it at the 10 meg, but we got 100 meg internet there. And with Silver Peak, you know, aggregating the two together, we'll get that higher bandwidth, and I'm spending money on with the Silver Peak, but in the end, I'm not increasing my MPLS.
Now, one of the things that remote, like regional banks often do is you use thin clients. So you use some sort of VDI solution. And the challenge with VDI solutions is that they're really sensitive to packet loss. You lose a couple of packets and the screen stutters, and you don't actually need a lot of bandwidth, but you need good bandwidth. Is that true for what you're doing?
So we are just starting to deploy VDI. We actually just spun up our first Horizon test set up this week, actually. I can't really comment on that exactly, but because of that, now that we are on SD-WAN on Silver Peak, that is giving us the ability to go ahead and deploy VDI. We're looking at, we've got a lot of older workstations out there that we were looking at needing to really ramp up a replacement project. And, you know, workstations are expensive, and we decided, hey, you know, let's get a couple of dozen VDI clients out there and start really proving this concept that it will work now. And so we've really just dug into that. I've talked to a lot of other banks on FSISAC, and they're, you know, I don't know what SD-WAN solution some of them are using, but they're saying that VDI just works amazing now over if you have a good WAN.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The challenge here is that even over the old traditional services, you know, the fixed line services. We call them MPLS, but they're not. Yeah. They're MPLS to the telco. It's funny how the telco names a service and we get to call it.
It's just an Ethernet circuit. It's all it
is. It's just a piece of bandwidth on an Ethernet tail. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's got MPLS in it, it's neither here nor there for us, right?
Right.
And the challenge is, though, is that the telco networks were often very badly put together. They were very latency sensitive. Variable or jitter, and they would also lose a lot of packets, and a lot of VDI over those circuits was suboptimal. But what we've heard a couple of times in stories from SD-WAN is this idea that because traffic quality is groomed, or because they apply this flow management, it's actually much more workable, even over bad, poor quality circuits. But a lot of this thin client stuff starts to work better than you might otherwise expect.
Yeah, one bank that I had mentioned, and they may, or that I had spoke to about VDI, they may actually be on Silver Peak, if I remember right now. Mm. But they had a location where their primary WAN circuit went down, and it had to run on their LTE and their LTE backup, and they didn't have some reporting set up to know that it was running on their LTE. And this was the director of IT talking. He said he didn't even know that the location was running on LTE until he got his cell bill the next month and saw that the data, you know, for that modem has skyrocketed, and looked into it. And he said the employees at the location didn't even know. And they're a full VDI shop. So I thought, well, that's pretty crazy that they're running VDI over LTE and the employees don't even notice.
So I wanted to ask you then, with your own experience, I think you've deployed maybe about half of SD-WAN to your branches. Is there a difference between what employees and applications are experiencing on the SD-WAN links as opposed to non-SD-WAN?
I don't know if they 100% notice or not, but I would definitely, just from some of our circuits that have packet loss, I know that those are definitely have been improved.
Mm-hmm. And are you getting any issues with VoIP or anything?
No, absolutely none at all.
Is that unexpected?
I would hope not. If you have everything set up within the SD-WAN system, right? Yeah. You know, Silver Peak, they have a great TAC that you can open tickets up and they'll respond to you pretty quickly. But where they really shine, and hopefully we're not just an outlier, but we have an amazing sales engineer. He is absolutely amazing. And I had a question about some QoS and our shaping policy yesterday. And, you know, he prefers that I just text him on a cell phone, and I just texted him and I said, "Hey, Jason, do you have, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, you know, open this afternoon?" He's like, "Yeah, I'll email you a Zoom link." And, you know, yesterday, 3 o'clock, we hopped on a Zoom and we went over some questions that I had.
Yeah, I'll come back to the voice question, because I think that's important, is because a lot of the times running VoIP on those dodgy links, you know, before we talked about packet loss and jitter and latency and all sorts of issues. And the fact that you can run VoIP over SD-WAN is not something that people on those bad links, on internet links, actually works.
Yeah, over internet for sure. Yeah, we have several locations that are have no MPLS. They're internet only. We do dual internet with two different providers, but they're dual internet and no issues.
No, that's a lot of money right there.
It's a lot of savings.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. And we're getting ready to spin up another site in Fort Worth, a new location. That's going to be a new big lending location. And we're not doing MPLS at all. We're doing, you know, we have AT&T and Spectrum fiber.
Doesn't matter
building.
How many times I tell people to stop using dedicated telco services.
But Yep.
All right.
Well, I think, Daniel, we've run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us, and thanks to Silver Peak for being a sponsor. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog that's at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.